This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Dragon's Egg by Robert L. Forward. Narrated by Todd McLaren. Prologue. Time, 500,000 B.C. Bu'u lay in his leafy arbor nest and looked up at the stars in the dark sky. The hairy young humanoid should have been asleep, but his curiosity kept him awake. A 500,000 years in the future, that twinkling of curiosity would have led his mind out into the universe to explore the mathematical mysteries of relativity. Now, Bu'u continued to stare at the bright stars above him. One speck suddenly flared brighter. Frightened but fascinated, Bu'u watched the growing point of intense light until it went behind a dense tree branch. He would be able to see it again if he went to the nearby clearing. He clambered down from his nest and into the striped coils of Ka. Ka did not enjoy his kill for long. Things were difficult for him in a world with two suns. The new sun was tiny and white, while the old one was big and yellow. The new sun circled constantly overhead. It never set, and he could no longer catch things at night. Ka died, along with other hunters who could not change their habits fast enough. For a year the new light shone from above, searing the sky. Then it slowly grew dimmer and dimmer, and within a few years, night returned to the northern hemisphere of Earth. 50 light years away from the solar system, there was once a binary star system. One star was in its normal yellow-white phase, but the other had bloated up until it turned into a red giant, swallowing the planets around it. The nuclear fuel for the red giant ran out just 50 years before Bu'u's curiosity got the better of him. With its fusion bomb center turned off, the energy the star needed to hold itself up against its self-gravitation was no longer available, and the star collapsed. At the center, the infalling matter became denser under the terrific gravitational pressure, until it turned almost completely into neutrons. The neutrons pressed closer and closer until they were packed radius to radius. Under these cramped conditions, the strong nuclear repulsion forces were finally able to resist the gravitational pressure. The inward rush of matter was quickly reversed, and the outward motion turned into an incandescent shockwave that traveled upward through the outer shell of the red giant. At the surface, the shockwave blew off the outer layers of the star in a supernova explosion that released more energy in 1 hour than the star had released in the previous 1,000,000 years. Beneath the expanding cloud of blazing plasma, the core of the red giant had changed. What had once been a large, red, slowly rotating balloon, 200 times bigger than the sun, was now a tiny, white-hot, 20-kilometer ball of ultra-dense neutrons, spinning at over 1,000 revolutions a second. The original magnetic field of the star had stayed trapped in the highly conductive, collapsing cloud of star stuff. Like the sunspot pattern on the original star, the magnetic field was not aligned with the spin axis of the neutron star, but was sticking out at an odd angle. One magnetic pole was very concentrated, and a little above the equator. The other, really a group of poles, was on the opposite side of the star. Part of its complex pattern was below the equator, but most of it was in the northern hemisphere. The almost solid trillion Gauss magnetic fields reaching out from the two magnetic poles of the rapidly spinning star tore into the glowing debris remaining from the supernova explosion. driven by the rapid rotation of the ultra-dense sphere. The magnetic fields threw the massive clouds of ions away from the star in scintillating gouts. Like a 4th of July pinwheel on the loose, the neutron star accelerated off to the south, directly toward its nearby neighbor, Sol, the magnetic propeller leaving a glowing wake streaming out behind. After a short while, the plasma density became thinner, and the rocket action stopped. But by then, the star had achieved a respectable proper motion of 30 kilometers per second, or one light year every 10,000 years. A tiny wanderer jaywalking across the star lanes of the galaxy. Time, 495,000 BC. As the neutron star spun its way through space, the debris it attracted by its gravitational field fell inward. When the interstellar material approached to within a few thousand kilometers of the 20-kilometer diameter ball, it was heated and stripped of its electrons by the intense gravity and the whirling magnetic fields. The ionized plasma then fell in elongated blobs toward the star, its velocity reaching one quarter of the speed of light as it struck the crust in the east and west magnetic polar regions. The bombarded crust responded with flares of charged particles that shot back out into space, gaining speed and radiating pulses of radio energy as the spinning magnetic field lines whipped them outward. Inflated by the pulsating radiation and streams of hot plasma from the spinning star, the cloud of gas from the original supernova explosion continued to expand at a speed of 1% that of light. After 5,000 years, the front of the shockwave passed through the solar system. For 1,000 years, the shielding magnetic fields of the Sun and Earth were buffeted by the invisible hurricane-force interstellar winds. The wiggling magnetic field lines lost their ability to keep the dangerous high-energy cosmic ray particles away from the fragile Earth. The ozone layer in the upper atmosphere collapsed, and the life forms on Earth were subjected to a harrowing barrage of mutating radiation. When the millennia-long storm finally waned, a new species of nearly hairless humanoids had emerged on Earth. The original band was small, but the individuals were smart. They used their intelligence to control things around them, instead of letting nature and the strong-muscled have their way. It wasn't too long before their ancestors were the only humanoids left on the planet. Time, 3000 BC. Traveling at its leisurely pace of one light year every 10,000 years, the neutron star began to approach the solar system. The intelligent beings who had been born in its baptism of invisible fire a 500,000 years ago had progressed to the point at which they began seriously to study the heavens. The neutron star glowed with a white-hot heat, but it was too tiny to be seen by mere human eyes. Although many times hotter than the Sun, the neutron star was not a hot ball of gas. Instead, the 67 billion G gravity field of the star had compressed its blazing matter into a solid ball with a thick crust of close-packed, neutron-rich nuclei arranged in a crystalline lattice over a dense core of liquid neutrons. As time passed, the star cooled and shrank. The dense crust fractured, and mountains and faults were pushed up. Most crustal features were only a few millimeters high, but the larger mountain ranges rose up almost 10 centimeters, poking their tops above the iron vapor atmosphere. The mountains were the highest at the east and west magnetic poles, for most of the meteoric material that fell on the star was directed there by the magnetic field lines. The temperature of the star had fallen since its birth. The neutron-rich nuclei on the glowing crystalline crust could now form increasingly more complex nuclear compounds. since the compounds utilize the strong nuclear interaction forces instead of the weak electronic molecular forces that were used on Earth. They worked at nuclear speeds instead of molecular speeds. Millions of nuclear chemical combinations were tried each microsecond, instead of a few per microsecond as on Earth. Finally, in one fateful trillionth of a second, a nuclear compound was formed that had two very important properties. It was stable, and it could make a copy of itself. Life had come to the crust of the neutron star. Time, 1000 BC. Still unseen by human eyes, the white-hot neutron star continued to approach the solar system. As the surface of the star began to cool through that small temperature range that was most conducive to nucleonic life, the original replicating nuclear molecule diversified and became more complex. Competition for the simpler non-living molecules that served as food became more intense. Soon, the primordial mana that had covered the crust was gone, and in its place were clumps of hungry cells. Some clumps of cells found that their topsides, which faced outward toward the cold, dark sky, were constantly at a lower temperature than their undersides, which were in contact with the glowing crust. They raised a canopy of skin up away from the crust, and soon were running an efficient food synthesis cycle using the heat engine that they had arranged between a stiff taproot penetrating deep into the hot crust and the cool canopy above. The canopy was a marvel of engineering. It used stiff crystals embedded with super-strong fibers to form a 12-pointed cantilever beam structure that raised the thin upper skin against the 67 billion G gravity field of the star. Of course, a plant's beam structure couldn't lift its topside very far. A plant might be as much as 5 millimeters across, but it could only raise a canopy up to a millimeter. The plants paid a price for their canopies and supporting frame. They were rigid and had to stay where they had rooted. For many, many turns of the star, nothing moved except for an occasional spray of pollen from the tip of a cantilever beam on one plant, followed by the contraction of a flap at the tip of a nearby plant. Then, many turns later, that action would be followed by the dropping of a ripe seed pod, which rolled away in the continual winds. One turn, a rolling seed pod broke against a chunk of crust. Its seeds scattered, and several of them started to grow. One was more vigorous than the others, and soon its canopy began to rise above those of its slower siblings. Suffocated in the heat radiated from the star below, and the underside of the taller plant above, most of the smaller seedlings died. One, however, underwent a strange transformation as its body functions started to fail. It had a mutant enzyme whose normal function was the fabrication and repair of the crystalline structure that held up the canopy. But under the influence of the distorted nucleonic chemistry of an organism near death, the enzyme went wild and dissolved the crystalline structure it was designed to protect. The plant turned into a sack full of juice and fibers and flowed down the slight slope upon which it had been rooted to a new resting place. The 12 pollen sprayers, slightly photosensitive in order to provide the optimum orientation for the canopy of the plant, worked their way around to the top. Now that the organism was out from under the blocking canopy of the larger plant, the errant enzyme controlled itself again. The plant sent down roots, rebuilt its canopy, and proceeded to give and receive many sprays of pollen. The mobile plant had many seedlings, all of which had the ability to dissolve their rigid structure and move if the conditions weren't right for optimum growth. Soon, the first animals roamed the surface of the neutron star, stealing seed pods from their immobile cousins and learning that there were many good things to eat on the star, especially each other. Like the plants they came from, the neutron star animals were only 5 millimeters across, but lacking stiff internal structures, they were flattened by the gravitation. The 12 photosensitive pollen sprayers and flaps became eyes, but they still retained their original reproduction function. The animals could grow bones whenever they wished. Most of the time, these were degenerate forms of the cantilever beams that were used to hold their eyes up on stalks so they could see further. But with a little concentration, a bone could be formed anywhere inside the skin sac. However, speed of bone forming was paid for in quality. The bones were made solely of crystallized internal juices. They did not contain the embedded fibers that made the plant structure so strong. That procedure took too much time. Unlike the plants, the animals had to contend with the star's magnetic field. The plants didn't move, so they didn't mind that they were stretched into a long ellipse aligned along the magnetic field lines. The bodies of the animals were also stretched into long ellipses. But since their eyes were stretched by the same amount, they were not aware of the distortion. However, the animals found that it was much harder to move across the magnetic field lines than along them. Most gave up trying. To them, the world was nearly one-dimensional. The only easy directions in which to travel were east and west, toward the magnetic poles. After a long time, plants and animals existed all over the surface of the neutron star. Some of the smarter animals would look up at the dark sky and wonder at the points of light they saw moving slowly across the blackness as the neutron star turned. The animals in the southern hemisphere of the star were especially bewildered by the very bright spot of light that stayed fixed over the south pole. It was the Earth's sun. The light was so bright and close that it didn't twinkle like the other specks of light. But except for using the star as a convenient navigation beacon to supplement their magnetic directional sense, none of the animals bothered to think more about the strange light. There was always plenty of food from the constantly growing plants and the smaller animals. An animal doesn't need to develop curiosity and intelligence if it has no problems that need solving. Time, 2000 AD. The blinking, radiating, spinning neutron star was now 1/10 of a light year from the sun. After a 500,000 years, the star had cooled, and its spin speed had slowed to only 5 revolutions per second. It still sent out pulses of radio waves, but these were but a weak remembrance of its brilliant earlier days. In a few 100 more years, the neutron star would pass by the solar system at a distance of 250 astronomical units. Its gravity would perturb the outer planets, especially Pluto, way out at 40 AU from the Sun. But Earth, snuggled up to Sol in its orbit of 1 AU radius, would scarcely notice the passage. The star would then leave the solar system, never to return. By now, the life forms on Earth had invented the telescope. But even this was inadequate to see the tiny pinpoint of light in the vast heavens, unless one knew exactly where to look. Would it pass unseen? Pulsar. Time, Thursday, 23 April, 2020. Jacqueline Carnot strode over to a long table in the data processing lab in the CCCP NASA ESA Deep Space Research Center at Caltech. A frown clouded her pretty face. The cut of her shoulder-length brown hair and her careful choice of tailored clothing stamped her at once as European. Her skirt, blouse, and clogs were her only items of clothing. It was not that she did not own stockings, and purses, and makeup, and rings, and perfume, and other women's things. It was just that she was in too much of a hurry in the morning to bother with them, for she had work to do. The French government had not given her a state fellowship to study at the International Space Institute, so she could spend all morning getting dressed. The slender woman swiftly cleared the table of its accumulated scraps of paper and tossed down a long data record at one end. The cylinder of paper rolled obediently across the table, then obstinately off the end and 5 meters across the floor before it finally stopped. Jacqueline left the roll on the floor and started to analyze the data. This menial task would normally have been handled by a computer. Unfortunately, computers now insisted on a charge number for everything. And when Jacqueline had logged on this morning, she had found that the meager balance that she had been saving out of Professor Solinsky's allocation for her thesis had been swallowed up by another retroactive intercurrency account readjustment. She knew that Solinsky had plenty of rubles in his research budget. But without his budget authorization and his personal approval to the computer, by the crypto password that she knew but dared not use, she was reduced to waiting and hand processing until he returned. Actually, it was fun working with the numbers in this personal way. With the computer doing the analysis, the numbers would be crammed into digital bins, whether they were real data or noise. And right now, there was a lot of scruffy noise on the graph. The data Jacqueline was analyzing came from the low-frequency radio detectors on the old CCCP-ESA out-of-the-ecliptic probe that was the first major cooperative effort between the Soviets and the Europeans. Back in the early days of the race to the moon, the Europeans had supplied the first Soviet lunar rover with laser retroreflectors. Then, after a disastrous experience with the Americans, in which one of America's 4 precious shuttle spacecraft and Europe's only space lab had exploded on the launch pad, the Europeans had turned back to the East for cooperation. The Europeans built the instrumentation for an out-of-the-ecliptic spacecraft that was launched by one of the giant Russian launch vehicles. The craft first traveled 5 astronomical units out to Jupiter. But once there, instead of taking pictures and going on to other planets as previous spacecraft had done, it went under Jupiter's south pole to shoot straight up out of the plane formed by the orbits of the planets. As the spacecraft climbed up out of the ecliptic plane, its sensors began to see a new picture of the sun. The magnetic fields that blossomed out from the sunspots at the middle latitudes of the sun were now attenuated, while new effects began to dominate the scene. The data from the CCCP-ESA out-of-the-ecliptic probe had been thoroughly analyzed by many well-funded scientific groups early in the mission. The information gathered had shown that the sun had a case of indigestion. It had eaten too many black holes. The scientists found an extremely periodic fluctuation in the strength of the sun's polar magnetic field. The magnetosphere of the sun had many variations, of course. Each sunspot was a major source of variability. However, sunspots were irregular in time and were so strong in the middle latitudes that they dominated everything. It was not until the OE probe was above the sun, sampling data for long periods of time, that the finely detailed, highly periodic variations in the radio flux were found and interpreted as periodic variations in the sun's magnetosphere. It was finally concluded that the sun had 4 dense masses, probably miniature primordial black holes, orbiting around each other, deep inside the sun. These disturbed the sun's normal fusion equilibrium by gnawing away at its bowels. the effect of the black holes on the sun would become serious in a few million years. But all they did now was bring on an occasional ice age. Although the human race realized that the sun was not a reliable source of energy for the long term, there was little they could do about it. After a short flurry of national and international concern over the death of the sun, the human race settled down to solving the insoluble problem in the best way that they knew. They ignored it and hoped it would go away. It was now 2 decades later. Miraculously, one of the 2 communication transmitters on the satellite and 3 of the experiments were still running. One of them was the low-frequency radio experiment. Its output was sprawled across a table and down a computation lab floor, slowly being marked up by the swift, slender fingers of a determined graduate student.
"Damn, here comes the scruff again,"
Jacqueline muttered to herself as she slid the long sheet across the table and noticed that the slowly varying trace with a complex sinusoidal pattern began to blur. Her job for her thesis was to find another periodic variation in that complex pattern that would indicate that there were 5 or more black holes. Failing that, she needed to prove that there were only 4. At least she had been able to get her peripatetic advisor to agree that a well-documented negative result would be an adequate thesis. However, she was worried. The scruff was blurring the data, ruining a good portion of it. It wouldn't have made much difference if the good part had shown some new pattern and she could have ferreted out a new black hole to add to the sun's problems. However, it was now pretty obvious that she would have to be content with a negative thesis. And this noise was going to make it difficult to convince the examining committee that there were only 4 black holes in the sun. She stared at the noisy portion as her arms rapidly slid the long sheet of paper across the table.
"I shouldn't complain about this antique spacecraft," she said. "But why did it have to start stuttering now?"
She moved along the trace. The scruff got worse, then slowly faded away. When she got to the clear section, she started to measure the amplitude averages again. In a way, it was good that the computer was not blindly working on this data. She had enough sense to ignore the noisy parts and thus end up with a very clean spectrum. But if the computer had been handling the data, it would have folded the scruff in with the good data, and the resulting spectrum would have had a lot of spurious spikes that would have given the examination committee plenty of ammunition. Jacqueline finished her data analysis late in the evening. She looked at the neat figures in the notebook.
"That is the hard way to analyze data," she said to herself. "Tomorrow it gets worse, when I have to read it all into the computer. I hope old Sawface has loosened the purse strings by then."
Jacqueline glanced wearily at the long, tumbled ribbon of paper on the floor, and, swirling it around, finally found a loose end and started to roll it up.
"Up and down with a double hump, triple hump, bump, repeat twice more, then scruff, then up and down with a double hump, triple hump, bump, repeat twice more, then scruff."
Jacqueline stopped her semi-automatic mouthing of the pattern on the roll. She quickly gathered up the whole pile of paper and carefully carried it to one end of the long room and stretched it out on the floor. She then went to one end and strode rapidly along it, looking for the noisy portions.
"The scruff is periodic," she exclaimed.
The noise seemed to have a period of about a day, and as she went from one end of the roll to the other, it slowly drifted with respect to the more regular periodic bumps that were the meat of her thesis. She had previously thought that the noisy portions were due to random malfunctions of the spacecraft, but now the periodic nature of the scruff made her look elsewhere for the cause.
"It could be that the spacecraft develops an arc in the transmitter for a few hours every day, but that doesn't sound very likely," she said.
She finished rolling up the paper and, carrying the roll with her, went into the communications lab. The first thing she looked up was the spacecraft log. Fortunately, that information was in the general library file, and the computer would let her look at that without charging her. She flashed the log backwards, page by page. Most of the entries had her name entered: J. Carnot, ESA, account SA-2J, LFR data dump.
"I seem to be the only one using this satellite," she said.
Finally, she came to an engineering note. Once every few days or so, during slack periods, the spacecraft engineers at the CCCP NASA ESA Deep Space Network Communication Center would take the spacecraft through its engineering checklist. Power 22%, nominal. X-band downlink, 80%, nominal. K-band downlink, dead. Attitude control, dead. Spin rate, 77 microrad per second. Functioning experiments: low-frequency radio, solar IR monitor, X-ray telescope, standby.
"Only two experiments on," she said. "The engineers must have turned off the X-ray telescope since the last time I checked."
She looked at the number for the spin rate, flipped the computer terminal into compute mode, and made a quick calculation.
77 microradians per second comes out to be a little more than one revolution per day. About the same period as the scruff. The scruff must be caused by the effect of the solar heating on the transmitting antenna, or some other solar effect.
She logged off the terminal, took the roll of paper, and headed back through the pre-dawn hours to her room. The roll would join the many other rolls that lay stacked in a pile on her bookshelf, while she joined the rest of Pasadena in sleep. Time, Friday, 24 April, 2020. In her sleep, Jacqueline was flying. No, not flying, but drifting through empty space. She looked down and finally realized where she was. Below her was the bright globe of the sun. Spread out before her was the whole solar system as seen from above. Her astronomically trained mind had placed the dream planets in their proper positions, and she could almost imagine faint lines tracing out the nearly circular orbits that gave the solar system the appearance of a bull's-eye target from this perspective. She found the tiny double planet system that was the Earth-Moon pair, and was straining to try and make out detail on the Earth when the slow, inexorable rotation of her body dragged her eyes away from the scene. Unable to turn her head around any further, she was forced to gaze upwards away from the sun, her arms and legs outstretched in the form of an X.
"Just like the low-frequency radio antennas sticking out of the OE probe," she thought.
Soon, the rotation brought her body around again, and she admired the view. She finally concentrated on looking at the north pole of the sun. She had no trouble looking at the sun despite its brightness, and she searched for any variations on the nearly featureless surface. As she stared, she saw nothing with her eyes, but she finally began to notice weak pulsations in her arms and legs. A double pulse, triple pulse, pulse.
"I'm picking up the complex radio signal of the orbiting black holes," she thought, as her body continued to revolve.
Soon, she could no longer see the sun, but she could still feel the pulsations in her arms and legs. Then, while staring out at right angles from the sun, she felt a rapid tingling sensation building up in her right arm. It became stronger and stronger, nearly blotting out the slower, rhythmic pulsations.
"The scruff!" she exclaimed,
and then began to laugh at herself.
"Nothing like getting yourself so wrapped up in your thesis work that you dream you have become the spacecraft yourself,"
said Jacqueline as she sat up in her room. She looked at the bustling noonday traffic out her window and rubbed the prickles out of her right arm, restoring the circulation it had lost while trapped under her exhausted body. She was halfway through her belated breakfast when the dream surfaced again in her mind. Although she knew the spacecraft's operational characteristics almost as well as she knew the operating characteristics of her own body, it did seem strange to her that in the dream, the scruff came when she was looking away from the sun, not toward it. She thought about it for a while, then went to her bookshelf and got down the roll she had been working on the previous night and an older one from several months ago. She unrolled a section from each of them on the floor, one above the other, and slid the old one back and forth until the slowly varying complex pattern caused by the orbital motion of the black holes was matched up on the two rolls. She then looked along both sheets and came to the noisy portions. They were different. First of all, the scruff a few months ago was significantly weaker, although that could be explained by the grating piece of equipment or insulation. But there also seemed to be a definite shift in the position of the peak of the scruff activity with respect to the position of the sun. She got out an even older roll and checked it. The scruff was very weak now. In fact, she remembered that the computer had had no trouble obtaining a nice, clean spectrum from this data, since the spectral energy in the noise had been so small. Again, however, there seemed to be a delay in the position of the peak intensity of the scruff.
Well, this is one time when the number-crunching objectivity of the computer is orders of magnitude better than the highly subjective human hand and eye. It is back to the computer for you, Jacqueline, she said to herself. But first, you have to get some more computer time from old Sophie's.
Jacqueline walked across the Caltech campus to the Space Physics Building. The huge edifice, built in the days when space budgets were a significant fraction of a nation's budget, was now the Space Physics Building in name only. Only the basement computer room and the first-floor offices contained space research activities. The remaining floors of the building had been taken over by graduate students of the Social Sciences Department. If the Caltech Jet Propulsion Laboratory's Combine had not been able to talk NASA, the Europeans, and the Russians into combining their dwindling national space budgets into supporting one international space research center with a single deep space network, then there would be no deep space research at all. After the Americans had given up sponsoring deep space probes, and the European Space Agency had broken into squabbling factions after the loss of Spacelab, the Russian planners, without visible competition, had lowered their priority for deep space research to almost zero, and concentrated their funding on manned and unmanned Earth orbital ventures. The Cold War was still on, but it had degenerated into an almost automatic name-calling at the United Nations. The Russian standard of living rose, and as it did, the party planners found that they had to give more and more attention to a no longer docile population and could not justify a separate deep space program. Jacqueline walked down the almost deserted corridors of the Space Physics Building to Professor Vladimir Solinsky's office. Jacqueline hesitated, then knocked.
"Da," said a gruff voice.
Jacqueline opened the door and walked in. A thin, middle-aged gentleman swiveled away from a computer screen filled with text and Cyrillic characters and turned to look at her. Jacqueline's Russian was good enough that she could tell that he was reading a science news article about the supposed discovery of a magnetic monopole in some iron ore in Nigeria. Solinsky's clothing was unusual for a Russian. It was a tailored suit in the latest European style. Its very presence on his spare frame advertised that the wearer was a multicultured world traveler who was given significant freedom and even more significant financial reimbursement by a worldly wise Russian government that expected great things from him. The man's balding head bent forward as he peered over his reading glasses at the young woman.
"Jacqueline," Solinsky said, his face beaming with pleasure. "Do come in, young lady. How is your thesis work coming? Have you found another collapsed substellar object?
Jacqueline grinned inwardly at the Russian's refusal to call them miniature black holes. Unfortunately, the Americans and Englishmen who had first popularized the concept of black holes were not aware that the phrase black hole had a context in the Russian language that was not used in polite company.
I have used up my account, and the computer will not talk to me anymore, she said. I thought I had plenty of computer time left, at least for another month of work, but a retroactive intercurrency adjustment cancelled it out.
Professor Solinsky flinched. He had been afraid of something like that. His budget from the Soviet Academy was quite limited, but worst of all, it was in rubles. Now that the Chinese and Russians were heating up the border war in Mongolia again, the Russian ruble had been falling fast in the international money markets. He had been glad to have Jacqueline working for him, for she came free. As one of its few full-time graduate fellows, ESA paid all her expenses. When he had come to America to work in the International Space Institute, he had despaired of being able to afford any graduate student help. So getting Jacqueline had been a lucky break. She was smart. And pretty, besides.
All right, he sighed. I will transfer more money from my main account. But my account will also be depleted by the same adjustment. I am afraid that this means that I won't be able to go to the Verona conferences this summer.
He turned to the computer terminal at his desk and carried out a short dialogue with a financial account program. He turned after a minute and said,
"The computer will now talk to you again. However, please be prudent in what you ask it to do, for the rubles are getting scarce." "Thank you, Professor Solinsky," Jacqueline replied. "However, I still have much work to do to finish my thesis. As of now, I cannot find any other periodic signals in the data. Also, the records from the probe are getting worse. The noise on the traces is growing in amplitude, and I have to throw out a good portion of the data. The noise itself is interesting, though. I went back through some old traces, and I find it is not only increasing in amplitude, but the peak seems to shift in time with respect to the radio signals from the sun."
"Ah, the scroff, as you call it," he said. "It is not going away, but getting worse." "Well, we should not expect much from a spacecraft that is so old."
"But the shift with time is strong evidence that the scroff is not generated by the sun," Jacqueline protested. "I think we ought to look into it."
"I can think of many mechanisms whereby the failing electronics on the spacecraft could produce this static," he replied with a smile. "We want you to get your thesis done without spending too many of my precious rubles, so I think we ought to concentrate on the analysis of the radio data that is not bothered by the noise."
"But it would not take long for me to have the computer go back through the data and get a good estimate of the drift," she said.
Then, remembering the tingling in her right arm, she suddenly became sure of something else, although it was against all logic that her position in bed in Pasadena had anything to do with an inanimate spacecraft cruising through space 200 astronomical units away. Yet many a scientific idea had first surfaced in a dream of the researcher. Perhaps her subconscious was trying to tell her something.
"I am almost positive that the scroff is being picked up by just one of the four antenna wires," she said eagerly. "If I could get the engineers to switch the data collection mode to read each antenna separately..."
"Net!" boomed Professor Solinsky. "Paying the deep space network to point their antennas to a given spacecraft to collect a one-hour prearranged data dump is expensive enough.
Do you realize how much it costs to send a command to a spacecraft?
She started to speak, but Zelensky cut her off as he dropped his recently acquired American professor image and reverted to his autocratic old-school Russian stance.
Нет, нет, нет,
he said, as he turned his back on her and switched on his computer console.
До свидания, мадемуазель Карно.
Jacqueline started to speak, but realized that the interview was over. She seethed inwardly, but finally decided to leave and take her frustrations out on the computer. At least he had transferred the money to her account before he had turned her off. Quietly closing the door behind her, she made her way downstairs to the computer console room.
I wonder how much a command change really does cost, she thought as she made her way down the steps. I will go out to Jet Propulsion Laboratories, talk to the Deep Space Network engineers, and find out if it is expensive as he thinks it is.
With the computer glad to see her again, now that she had money in her account, she read in the figures that she had laboriously extracted the previous evening. She then ran an analysis of the collected data. The peaks in the power spectral density curve were still in four families. The four lowest peaks were the fundamental orbital frequencies of the four black holes, while the higher harmonics were evidence of the slight ellipticity of the orbits. The basic pattern had not changed for decades. Although the black holes were orbiting in the interior of the sun, where the densities were hundreds and thousands of times greater than water. As far as the ultra-dense black holes were concerned, they were orbiting in a near vacuum. She searched carefully between the four lowest spikes, but could find no evidence of another peak. She had the computer repeat her search, and it came up with three 2-sigma candidates. But they looked like noise to her, and a quick check with a random half-data set proved her right. She was through for the time being, for a data dump was not scheduled for another week. But while she was on the computer, she decided to have another look at the noise problem. She first wrote a program to extract the noisy portions from the data sets, then to find the maximum of the amplitude of the scruff, which was a hard concept for the computer to grasp, then to plot the phase of the scruff maximum with respect to the position of the sun. In the process, she learned that the spin rate of the satellite had increased slightly in the past years, somehow gaining angular momentum from the solar wind and light pressure. Further examination of the drift of the phase and some calculations of the orientation of the spacecraft with respect to the sun found that the peak in the scruff stayed constant with respect to the distant stars.
That means that whatever the source of the noise, it is outside the solar system, Jacqueline exclaimed.
Then she realized that she had never asked herself what the scruff really looked like. On the hard copy printout of the reconstituted analog signal from the spacecraft, the scruff just looked like random fuzz. She cleared the screen and called up the latest data dump. The curve of the low-frequency radio readout wound its familiar way across the screen. She stopped it as she came to the maximum of the scruff. The scruff was so strong in this section that it often saturated the screen. She called on a section of the data analysis program that she had seldom used before, and a small section of the data was expanded on the screen. The hours-long humps that were the subject of her thesis were now stretched out so much that only a portion of one of them could fit into the screen. The scruff now dominated the screen and looked as noisy and nasty as ever. She called for another expansion, and the computer activated an override warning circuit. Warning: plot scale incompatible with data digitalization rate. Please confirm command. Jacqueline hesitated slightly, then hit the confirm key. Immediately, a set of almost random dots filled the screen. The short-term variation from point to point was strong, but the general amplitude level seemed to rise and fall slowly, with a period of many minutes. Again she called on the computer to carry out an operation on the data that she had never used before. She had been interested solely in the variations of the data, with periods of weeks to days. Now she asked it to carry out a harmonic analysis with periods of seconds. Again the computer complained. Warning. Spectral analysis scale incompatible with data digitalization rate. Please confirm command. There was no hesitation this time. Jacqueline had hit the confirm key long before the computer had printed its objections. The spectral analysis plot flashed on the screen. There was a large spike around 1 hertz that represented the 1 per second data digitalization rate. But at 0.005 hertz, there was a strong spike, indicating a periodic fluctuation with a 200-second period. However, the 200-second variation could have been caused by a beating between the 1 hertz data sampling rate of the spacecraft and some high-frequency oscillation that was close to some harmonic of the sampling rate. Jacqueline felt from the behavior of the data that a high-frequency variation was causing the scruff. But it would be hard to prove it with the spacecraft sampling rate set at 1 sample per second. Jacqueline, her enthusiasm finally exhausted by confusion and sleepiness, dropped the hard copy printouts of the data into Professor Solinsky's mailbox and went off to bed. She again had a dream about flying above the solar system. Only this time she was whirling around rapidly. She awoke feeling dizzy, then went back to sleep to dream ordinary, quickly forgotten dreams. After awakening the next day, Jacqueline went by Professor Solinsky's office. His door was open, and her data sheets were spread out on his desk. He was talking with Professor Cologne, the astrophysicist.
This high-frequency scruff is definitely not random noise, for there is evidence of a strong periodicity of 199 milliseconds, or a little over 5 cycles per second. The beating between the 199 millisecond pulsations and the 1 hertz data sampling rate gives it the 200-second beat pattern. However, it is not a 200-second fluctuation, because the engineering interruptions and the science data are not exactly an even number of seconds long, and the 200-second beat starts with a new phase after each engineering readout. If you take enough data and do an analysis of it, you find the 199-millisecond periodicity.
As he spoke, Professor Solinsky held up Jacqueline's printout. Professor Cologne studied it briefly, then returned it with a comment, "It has all the earmarks of a pulsar, but there just isn't any known pulsar of that frequency. I would suspect the spacecraft somehow has found a way to become a low-frequency radio oscillator." Professor Solinsky saw her standing in the door.
"Ah, Jacqueline, come in. I was just showing Professor Cologne our latest data. I have decided that we ought to arrange to have the data digitalization rate increased to at least 10 times per second, so we can obtain a better idea of the time-varying nature of these pulsations."
"But the cost,"
Jacqueline interjected.
"Yes, it will cost some money. But by the time the computer billing gets to us, we will be well into the new planning year," he replied. "Could you visit the JPL people and arrange for the change?"
"None to do,"
muttered Jacqueline under her breath.
"First, not enough money, and now plenty of money."
Aloud, she replied,
"Yes, Professor Solinsky. Do you also want to try reading out the antennas sequentially?"
"Yet,"
he replied brusquely.
"How many times must I remind you? Only change one parameter at a time in an experiment."
"Yes, Professor,"
she said, and practically bowed her way out of the office. Once in the hall, she found herself automatically heading down the stairs to the computer room. She stopped and started to turn back to go to JPL. but then she decided to spend a little more time learning how the spacecraft command system operated. She felt that perhaps she could not only satisfy Professor Solinsky, but also her own curiosity. After a few hours spent browsing through the engineering handbooks, she smiled and headed up the stairs, where she caught the Caltech jitney bus to JPL. Solinsky's name moved her swiftly through the administrative maze, and she shortly was assigned to Donald Niven, one of the JPL project managers. When she walked into the office she had been directed to, she saw a chunky young man with neatly trimmed dark hair and the slacks, sports coat, and tie that seemed to be the professional uniform of the engineers at JPL. She guessed that he was in his late 20s. She had thought that a project manager would be someone older, but as their conversation proceeded, she could tell from his cool, calm, methodical questions that, despite his age, he had acquired years of experience in the Deep Space Network organization. Their discussion was half technical, half financial.
"So the length or complexity of the command has almost no bearing on the cost?" she asked.
"That's right," Donald said. "So that groups like yours could plan their expenditures, we worked out a standard rate for each command cycle."
"Suppose a command has a series of steps in it?" she asked.
"As long as the steps are something for the spacecraft computer to go through and do not involve us, then the charge is the same for 1 or 10 steps, he replied. "What do you have in mind?"
Jacqueline got out her program sheets.
Donald swung his computer console around so they could both look at it. He typed in the code for the OE spacecraft operations manual.
"The first thing I want to do is increase the low-frequency radio data digitalization rate to its maximum," she said. "Then, after a week of high-rate data collection, I want to have the data taken alternatively with the 4 antennas, each one taking data for 1 minute at a time. After that, I want to have the X-ray telescope reactivated. It has a 1-degree field of view, and I want it to scan between these 2 angles at a rate of 1 degree per day."
Jacqueline handed over the sheet of paper, and he took it. "I see these are in spacecraft coordinates," he said, his opinion of the young woman increasing with every second. "Thanks for taking the trouble to convert them for me."
"It was no trouble," she replied calmly. "I have been living with that spacecraft so long that I practically think like it."
Together, they worked out the command procedure, and Donald transferred it to the programming section. The computer would actually do the programming, but the programmers had to take the computer result through several tests to make sure that some bugs had not crept into the computer simulation in the decades since the spacecraft had been launched.
"I'll give you a call when the command is ready," Donald said. "It'll be a few days before the formal procedure is finished. Fortunately, I don't think we will have any trouble getting permission from the sponsoring agency. Although the experiment package was built by ESA, the spacecraft itself was built by the Russians. So the authority for command changes rests with the Soviet Academy of Science, and Professor Solinsky's name should be good enough for them. Do you have a telephone number where I can reach you?"
Time, Friday, 1 May, 2020. As the days passed, Jacqueline and Donald spent many hours poring over the command timeline. It was a long sequence, with even longer delays in it.